Welcome back. I think we're at episode 345, 345. Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim, and I'm certainly doing better than the red heifer in Jerusalem is about to be doing. For the first time in 2,000 years, they're going to do a large animal sacrifice on the actually on the Temple Mount. It'll be directly adjacent to the mosque, and I think it's very important people pay attention to this because. It is in Jewish prophetic lore, the beginning of the, first of all, it gives the ability, for, the Israelis to, recreate the temple. They can start building the third temple once the red heifer has been slaughtered. So that is troubling because, of course, they're going to have to bulldoze the Dome of the Rock in order to achieve that. But moreover, it is really what troubles me about this is the timing relative to the Iranian mess, which we'll discuss. I'm sure you know the eschatologic Christians who have believed that there has to be a nuclear war in order for Jesus to return. This
Yes.
has been a Republican Party sort of plank for, 20 years or something.
That stems from the Scofield Bible, right?
It's correct. Yeah,
Yeah,
exactly.
which is
It's
commissioned
correct.
by the Jews, but
Yes,
late 19th
indeed.
century, yeah.
And
I think it was
eschatological.
Samuel was I think it was Samuel Untermeyer, right? The
Yes. Yeah,
yeah.
you got it right. Yeah,
Patriot.
anyway, so it's a bizarre way of looking at the world, but they need the Christians need the eschatologic Christians, these guys, the messianic Christians need this red heifer to occur, and they are the ones that actually bred it. They've been breeding these things, trying to produce them, and they produced like four or five that they thought were worthy. They came to Israel a couple years ago, and one of them was awarded the title by the rabbis of the sacrificial heifer. And so now they've built a huge platform, a stage actually, right on the Dome of the Rock. And on the 22nd, this Monday, they're going to perform the ritual. So just a couple thoughts here. One, it shows that the nation of Israel is in a though it presents itself as a secular kind of modern democracy, is actually in being controlled by individuals with a Deuteronomic Old Testament view of the world, which is not good because it's so violent toward other ethnicities. But they couldn't really pull this off this group was not in control of Israel. The secularists were up in arms, but they can't stop it. The Jerusalem Post had an article, and it explained that the Orthodox Jews need the red heifer to be sacrificed before they can build the third temple. So this was the Deuteronomic vision of the world was then backed up by Netanyahu, who has referred to Hamas as Amalek, which is the individuals in Deuteronomy that were en enemies of the Israelites. So you can see that we are, politically in the throes of a very fundamental Judaism. This is the group that's controlling Israel at the moment, obviously. And so then what troubles me is that they have in the past used typologic symbolism, relating to the rebuilding of the temple or the destruction of the temple in their false flags, and specifically 911, which I've said this 911 is a representation of Tisha B'Av, the date that the Jews celebrate or mourn the destruction of the two temples by the Babylonians and then the Romans. Both of the destruction of the temples occurred on the same date, according to lore. The historians, made this case. So anyway, that date was a celebration or of. Actually, it is a celebration because they talk about the rebuilding of the temple in the Jewish holiday, and so 911 was typologically linked into the destruction of the temple and its rebuilding. And so now, when you have April the 22nd being the date for the first sacrifice of a red heifer in 2,000 years, and this occurs at a moment when Israel has deliberately provoked this exchange with Iran, it is just troubling because one can easily imagine the fundamentalists, actually looking for, a kind of atomic warfare as a kind of the declaration that the, well, both the fundamental Christians, but even some eschatologic Jews believe that there has to be this war in order for the Messiah to come. And I would point out that this animal that's going to be slaughtered Monday is the 10th red heifer. It's only happened 9 times before in Israel's history, so that this is the 10th one. It has been sanctioned by the rabbinical governing body of Israel. And the Jewish scholars and prophets have often said that this 10th animal would only be found and sacrificed when the king Messiah was ready. So the Jewish understanding of Messiah is that of a world ruler, world dictator. You can look at the Dead Sea Scrolls for just how severe his control over the world will be. I can quote the passages, but you get the picture. You're talking not talking about a Jesus Christ character, but more of a King David on steroids type guy. He's going to be a very authoritarian individual. So all of this is a big troubling mix to me, and obviously I cannot possibly predict dates or what it actually means, because even though I think it's unlikely actually that these things are not all associated, 9/11 and the sacrifice of the red heifer, because I do believe these individuals are creating kind of a timeline based on prophecy. They're fulfilling roles that they understand, and this is going to help them move toward this kind of religious dictatorship that I think they envision. Anyway, that is the situation, and I think people should actually, kind of pay attention to this, particularly if in the next week we find out that the response that Israel had to Iran's bombing, which occurred this morning, which was very tepid, and
Yes.
people were surprised at that this was such a meek response. If that turns out just to have been a probe to kind of find weaknesses in the missile defense of the Iranians, and we have on Monday or any day thereafter next week a massive attack, I would say that the possibility that the red heifer is not basically being set up to as the beginning of a much bigger world war, frankly. So I think we should kind of pay attention to this, be aware of it, and we will see, what occurs during this next week and the weeks beyond, because the attack on Israel by the Iranians was completely successful, as I'm sure you've been reading and people have read that a number of missiles got in. They basically damaged the areas that they were trying to damage. The attack was a technological marvel. It's the longest range swarm drone attack that's ever occurred. And it shows, at least to my mind, that the Iranians can strike and destroy things in Israel just at will. There's really nothing that can stop the hypersonic missile that come in back of drone swarms. There's no missile defense that can possibly stop them. And so what the, so in one version of reality, this was understood by the Israelis, who then produced a tepid response because they didn't want actually to provoke another response by Iran. And this could lead to a more peaceful world, perhaps, where Israel is actually respecting the rights of other nations out of self-interest, because the technology of this, one Islamic country is now at a level that they can't be bullied. They simply have the power to, I'm not sure they could actually destroy Israel, but they could certainly, if they have the number of hypersonic missiles, I believe they had the kind of warheads, these high-tech thermobaric warheads, which can really cover large areas, they could really depopulate a lot of Israel. So this, if that is the case, then Israel would be wise to respect the Iranians and not blow up their consulates or assassinate their scientists at will. After the attack, I thought the thing that was most telling was the Iranian top general came on the air and he said, okay, this is, basically a declaration. From now on, when the Israelis attack us, when they attack our interests or our people anywhere in the world, this will be the response. We will response from Iran. We will use our missiles, and that will, basically be how we defend ourselves. So that's pretty cocky of this individual. So I would also suggest that, and I mentioned this before, the idea that the Iranians don't have nuclear weapons is laughable. They have them, and they have every reason to not declare this, but I'm sure they have probably 20 or 30 that they've been able to gin together. I mean, my God, these people are just technologically as savvy as anyone on the planet. I mean, the swarm that they produce, the timing of this over such a long range, and then to hit targets with such precision, I mean, they have got the delivery side of a nuclear war down to a T. I mean, they may be the best in the world at this point, frankly. Just extraordinary how accurate the missiles were, and how, bearing in mind that the U.S. had been in there to prepare Israel for the attack. I mean, they were all there. The Navy was there, the CIA. I mean, every imaginable defense against missile attack that the U.S. had been installed, and the Iranians just went right through them. If you've seen the videos of the swarm comes in, the defense goes off, they're shooting everything down, they're destroying everything, and then all of a sudden the hypersonic missile comes right through the mist and then blows up in exactly where it's supposed to. So the delivery side is in place, and I suspect that if this is a real world, and I don't know if this is the case, the Israelis will be wise not to provoke Iran any longer in the way they have in the past, because they now are able to deliver a violent blow against Israel. I'll just finish this rant with, I'm also worried that this is an unreal world. And this would lead into the idea of the red heifer, because the fact is that I don't know if the mullahs are real. They always fool us with these dialectics. They create these struggles which we think are real, and then there's a slaughter that is based upon this, purportedly real dialectic that's going on. But in fact, what's happened, World War I, they've taken control of both sides of the political process, and then they just destroy the people underneath them in a war. And Iran is much more complicated than the Europeans in trying to understand it. I don't pretend to. I would just note that I am concerned that the mullahs are actually under control. I mean, I certainly believe the Saudi Arabians are, for example, but the Iranians have always been different. They are, there's such a deep culture. So I think they would be very hard to put puppets in place. It just seems much more complicated than in other countries. So perhaps they are legit, and then the dialectic isn't some kind of theatrical production just, to provide the pretext for the war. I hope that it is the case, and I hope that their technical advances and their military might will now bring Israel basically to try to promote a different national behavior.
Well, the threat that Iran has the capability to deliver hypersonic missiles that overwhelm outflank or bamboozle the Golden Dome defense system.
Iron Dome.
I'm sorry, or Iron Dome.
Yeah.
Might lead to a you know a panic population. All of a sudden, Israel is faced with losing 4 or 5 million of its citizens, and they flee to the four corners of the world and bless those countries.
I got an email from a guy I exchanged with. He's taken off. He saw the the tea leaves, and he said, okay, I'm just gonna spend like a couple months abroad for let this all blow over,
Yeah, and the idea that Israel exists, of course, is a provocative, indefensible nation. If it can't overwhelm and overawe its the local countries there, its neighbors, and of course the U.S. backing of Israel is key to that. It is interesting that you'd have, I think, as many as four nations come to Israel's defense in response to this retaliatory strike. It just shows just how controlled these governments are. Remember, it was a retaliatory strike. Israel's attack early this morning is being reported as a retaliatory strike. Well, it was a tit for a tat for a tit. So we don't need, Israel struck the Iranian consulate in Syria, violating the sovereignty of two nations, killing two generals and I think a couple dozen people, Syrian and or Iranian, and it was a violation of the I think is the Geneva Accords, is it? Vienna Accords, Vienna Accords, international law that obviously consulate embassy is the sovereign territory. Syria is a sovereign country, although both the U.S., NATO, and Israel have been waging war on it I think for over 10 years now, provoking U.S. and Israel have been provoking a civil war there, trying to unseat Assad, and that just that's, we just accept that now or something. No one talks about the U.S. troops or soldiers in Syria in violation of Syrian sovereignty. Their oil and gas is being stolen, presumably by the Kurds, the Turks, and the Israelis. There's that Genie energy thing, which explains Gaza and also Syria. So there's, which also connects a lot of people in Washington, D.C. They're getting rich off it for the carnage they're creating in the area. Yeah, so if Iran does possess that capability to deter Israel, Israel's position becomes much less secure, and it's going to have to learn to live like a regular nation and negotiate in good faith its neighbors, which could be a good a good omen for peace in the area, meaning it will restrain Israel. But then again, we have the situation with this red heifer and these crazy rabbis, these Talmudists are trying to fulfill revelation or ha have this, and you realize, wait a second, this is supposed to be a sophisticated secular nation. In many respects, it is. Nevertheless, this is going on. I mean, well, this is kind of weird. And why is the U.S. backing? I mean, when Israel attacked the Iranian consulate on April 1st, U.S. said nothing, and then it claimed the U.S. would back Israel in any retaliatory strike. Basically saying it's just overlooking the fact that it violated international law and its treaty obligations to respect the Vienna convention on this. They're allowed to do that because apparently because the Holocaust, I guess, right? So here we are, and now and I think a lot of people have looked at this, that this was Netanyahu's attempt to kind of draw the U.S. into a regional war. Because Iran has been sort of a stumbling block to its plan to dominate the area, because Iran supports groups like Hezbollah, and it's a major power, regional power in the area. That's Shia power, which the Shiites or Shia Islam has been historically been proven to be far more of an adversary to the Zionists than say the Sunni, who are very corrupt. They're the minority. They're the one, they're the Saudis and all that. I think it was a yeah, it was a Saddam Hussein was a Sunni minority government, although he at least rhetorically and also would I think he was the last one to attack Israel with the Scud missiles in 1991.
That's right. Look what happened to him, of course.
So the whole air, I mean, really, it's just what I'm just starting to see four nations rallying to Israel's defense, even though Israel was the clear aggressor in this state, and how interlocked the CIA and multiple Western intelligence agencies in defense establishments are interlocked with the Israelis, all for the assistance of Israel, which is just there provoking, causing all these problems. The region would not have these problems, as most of the problems in the region, at least the geopolitical problems, would be solved if Israel didn't exist, you know.
But of course,
created,
I mean,
created by Israel.
The if you read the letters, you know, Lawrence Arabia and McMahon's letter, they set the Middle East up to be in conflict with itself by creating these artificial little tiny regions and putting puppets in place. I mean, the conflict in the Middle East that between these little Arab countries was established by the Judeo-Masonic, you know, authors of the map, and then of course the insertion of Israel is to take advantage of that, because you don't have the Arabs able to speak as one voice against Israel. You have these little tiny countries that are easily to cut apart and destroy.
Of course, its claim is based on a false prophecy too, just like the Red Heifer thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is just religious insanity, in my opinion. But nevertheless, it is driving. At least it's hard to say what is real to the people in charge. I mean, are they actually religious? I have no idea. They do purport to have this kind of Masonic Judaism as a, you know, as a philosophy anyway, and they certainly are connected into this prophetic, you know, lineage of that comes from the Old Testament. I mean, look at using Tisha B'Av as the date for 9/11, you know, and the destruction of the Solomon Building. You know, this is just an obvious typologic, you know, wink at the, you know, at the first destruction of the or the destruction in 73 of the Jewish temple. So this is their perspective. They are kind of re-establish the Masonic understanding of the world. The Hiram Abiff, you know, rebuilding the temple, is the philosophy that was behind the establishment of Israel. And so it is completely nihilistic. In other words, they will slaughter every Gentile on the planet.
Well, compare that to Iran, who bragged that their attack avoided any civilian any casualties.
Yeah, it was amazing.
It was purely symbolic, and they bragged about that effect to that.
Well, they did it just to show Israel, look,
yeah,
you can't stop us. We can come in. Now, I'll just give you like worst case for Israel. The Iranians have N number of hypersonic missiles. No one knows. It's state secret, obviously. Some of the upper ends are like 20,000. You know, they've been cranking these things out for a couple of years now.
Yeah, there's not much real estate in Israel.
Now, you have to bear in mind, if Iran struck hard and had a very, you know, successful result, they would completely wipe out the Israeli military. They'd wipe out their ability to use these nuclear ballistic missiles, because they would destroy all that. And they would take a lot of the population out. Now, if that happens, bear in mind that the neighbors of Israel would probably, because Israel would not have the capacity to defend itself, I think they might take an opportunity to come on in and set up shop and get rid of the Zionist government. I mean, in other words, I think Iran is far-fetched in my mind for them to like bring troops, because it's 1,000 miles between Tehran and Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. But the neighbors on the borders, I mean, I think it'd be a populist upheaval in order to get at the Israelis, because everyone in the region hates them so much, since they've all suffered, you know, and they've watched, for example, I mean, if Israel was without, you know, a powerful military, I think the Palestinians might have a thing to say to the people in Jerusalem, you know, and mm-hmm. in Tel Aviv and Haifa, you know, because so there's just they went with the approach they've taken of just complete nihilism, which is to say, just slaughter any Gentile we need. Nothing matters. There's no morality. This is a religious war, and we have the right, like in Deuteronomy, where you have the destruction of the ethnicities. That's why I refer to their kind of position politically as Deuteronomic, you know, this is where it comes from, that what you end up with is a lot of people that hate you. And this is what they've spawned. They haven't made peace with the region. They haven't tried to cooperate with anyone. They're setting up a religious and racial state, which they have lied about from the very beginning, right? Mm-hmm. They've always had this pretense of democracy and a two-party state, the secular face that Israel shows the world is now exposed as false. Everybody can see that at this point. And they're just trying to set up a state that will be, you know, a racial and religious monolith. And they don't care how many people they have to, you know, dispossess or kill in order to achieve it. I mean, I know that's kind of brutal, but I just can't describe the process in any other way, honestly. And so this has led to, well, everyone in the region just hates them. And they are kept in check because the Israelis have such, you know, an effective and powerful military.
Well, this is what's important here is with the Israeli Jews are such a small percentage of the global population and still a very small percentage of the Western nations that support them. So why is this a unanimity among the political class? Well, it's because Jews are very good at identifying key nodes or choke points, both political, economic, and cultural. So they have the political class completely either buffaloed or blackmailed or bribed. And so why the yeah. electorate, the populations, are growing very tired of Israel, the political class seems to be unanimous on it still for one reason or another.
Well, so, I just want to insert that I think a lot of them are crypto.
But then again,
to be Christians, but if you look at them, it's like the Bush family.
Yeah.
I mean, this family is supposed to be Christian, right? Except, well, they go to Skull and Bones or Freemason organizations and they take these secret oaths. What kind of a Christian is that? What kind of a Christian is a Zionist anyway? I mean, if they're following, you know, the religion that comes from the Gospels, you're not going to be a Zionist.
No, but a lot of people are now, they've more or less internalized the Scofield Bible. It's even bled into the Catholic Church, meaning that Israel is, you know,
the
chosen people. They're effectively their dual covenant heresy. They've embraced that, even though the Christianity has always been it's a new covenant, and it's this dual covenant heresy, which I see people repeat all the time, ignorantly repeat as if it's the chosen people. No, basically they were the chosen people, and they missed a train on that one.
Well, that's why it's called the New Covenant.
I mean, it's the New Covenant. Yeah, the New Testament, all that, Testament,
but actually the word is covenant. It is the New Covenant. So that the idea of like being a Zionist is basically being a traitor to the religion.
But this is what they've done, what they've come up with the term Judeo-Christian morality, as if there's some sort of fusion, a commonality, Western morality. Just, well, what's the Judeo-Christian position on abortion or gay rights, right? Well, there isn't any. There, you know, the organized Jewry. Yeah, I'm sure you can find individual Jews, lots of Jews probably, who aren't pro-abortion or aren't pro-gay agenda or aren't these things. But the organized Jewry is, and that's where the action is. That's where you have to focus on. I mean, you have to think of talk in these categories to understand the political situation in the West. If you can't think in these categories, then you don't understand what's going on. And you can't deal with it. You can't contend with the political reality. The political reality of the situation in the West is that organized Jewry enjoys inordinate power and influence, and it's damaging the world and those Western nations. And the problem is the political language, the political class, the political process. Isn't able to deal with that reality. So basically, if a politics is going to be effective, it has to deal with reality. If it's not dealing with reality, then it just aggravates the problem. It never deals with the problem. That's the problem with electoral politics and public discourse in the West. Then it's controlled by Jews.
And a good example is just this week, the Republican Speaker of the House pushed through the tax bill, right? Which include basically, I mean, the fund Ukraine, fund Israel. Now, this was declared as the revelation of the Uniparty because it's just completely opposed to all of the principles that the Republicans have claimed to be supporting. Remember, Johnson was supposed to come in there and clean up this mess with the Ukraine and the funding to it. And yet here he just completely collapses. And now you've got, well, I don't know, I forget the number, 100 billion. I mean, who knows?
He can't articulate a strategy to this other than prolonging the slaughter. That's what it is.
And this is the time when the Ukraine is completely marching into defeat. It's obvious that this is all good money after bad. There's no way at this point NATO is going to ever return.
They're depopulating the country.
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, Putin made a very chilling declaration this week, and he just said, look, this is how the war is going to end. You know, and he listed the categories, you know, if they were going to have control over the regions they had taken, the regime was going to be gone, the Zelensky regime, the Nazi philosophy, you know, was going to be taken out, and the whole country would be basically a Russian protectorate. And he just said, this is what is going to happen.
Well, isn't that what it's always been? Ukraine, it's Russian frontier.
Well, that's what the, you know, that's.
I'm looking at history. I'm like, Russia always, I mean, for the past several centuries, Russia has dominated Ukraine. Because look at a map. Well, I mean, it's like saying, declaring, what you're going to say, Russia's going to, you know, going to be have a navy in the Black Sea. Well, yeah, look at the map. Why wouldn't it?
So that's what the word Ukraine means, basically.
It is. Yeah, it means border or frontier. The idea of Russia will dominate or take over Ukraine. Well, so what?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, first of all, ever hear of near abroad and sort of spheres of influence? That's how you maintain a sane, balanced world and avoid constant warfare.
Yeah, but of course, in any case, we just are coughing up $100 billion,
yes,
a sinking ship. None of this can, of course, be ever paid back. I mean, the U.S. dollar is at this point just a lost cause. Mm-hmm. What is it? $1.5 trillion in interest payments a year, or something like this? Just some absurd number, something.
There's no even question of feasibility limitation. Even assuming what you want to do in Ukraine is desirable, you don't have the resources to do it, so you don't do it.
And all you're doing is depopulating.
That's
all that they're doing. And we have said now for like 2 years and 3 months or something, that's one of the goals. This is the problem, is that if you don't understand the world, you know, in the right way as what is real, you end up with the fake dialectic as something that's, you know, confusing. I mean, the oligarchs that produce the war and produce Zelensky, Soros and Molinsky, and others, the idea that they care about the Ukrainian people is ridiculous. They wanted to weaken Russia. At least that's the claim. And they were prepared, just forget the, you know, kind of the world that I would suggest of overall theatrics. Just look at the actual, what has been declared as the rationale behind NATO's behavior. They say that they're there to weaken Russia. Well, they're obviously not weakening Russia. Russia is stronger now than it ever has been.
Well,
right?
Didn't Blinken, who's Jewish, our Secretary of State, who identifies first as a Jew, that's what he said, a couple of weeks ago, declared that Ukraine would get NATO membership.
Yes.
They're at war. They're currently at war with Russia.
Right.
Why would you offer membership to NATO, to a country that whose borders, obviously are in flux, and they're in conflict with Russia?
That does create a rationale for more slaughter.
Yeah.
What difference does it make? NATO has given the Ukraine everything it has. The armaments are empty. The technology failed, right? I mean, the battlefields are littered with NATO technology. The Russian war technology was better. So the idea of bringing Ukraine into NATO, all that does is stop the possibility of some kind of end to the conflict, which would look to try to preserve as much of the Ukrainian population as they can.
Since 1991, or 1995, I guess, when it started, NATO expansion has been relentless.
Yeah.
Against, all going, extending all the way to the borders of Russia. So is it a defensive alliance?
Well, I mean,
if it's expanding, it just works.
I mean, defensive, we can call it anything you want. It's come right up to Russia's border. And
well,
it's
like, look at Israel calls defense, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the public is just bamboozled by words, but the fact is, NATO's always had the idea of getting into war with Russia, and the story they told, to create the rationale for the press that this was a coherent behavior, it's not just some kind of fake theatrical way of getting rid of a lot of Ukrainian people, is that our technology was better, our military technology was better. they created a huge army. I think it was 600,000 men. It was large, as large as the Russian army at the time, but it was been trained and it had NATO technology and NATO assistance. We were going to give them all of our, observation satellite information. And of course, we were going to give them all the weapons they needed. Well, look what's happened. The Russians are just absolutely grinding the Ukrainians to a very reduced population. And this is not going to be stopped by some kind of stupid proclamation saying, well, Ukraine's now in NATO. The only thing that's more stupid than that is this peace conference they're going to have in Switzerland, where they're bringing in like 100 nations and not including Russia.
Yes.
I mean, this is just absolutely cloud cuckoo land. That's going to do a lot of good. They'll come up with some kind of, well, here's what we will accept. This will be laughed at by Russia.
Well, they think they can exclude Russia, deplatform Russia, like they could destroy her economy. And they're not realizing that Russia and also Iran and China, with this is the formation of the BRICS, these countries are gaining a large measure of independence outside the Western control systems. So the sanctions offices, they've actually resulted in this, because people, the more sanctions you impose, the more incentive you create for people to get outside the dollar system. So it promotes a de-dollarization of the world economy. And that coupled with sort of the industrial capacity of China, the technical acumen, of Russia with its weaponry, with the missiles and Iran. And this is why I think, I guess the larger picture, geopolitical picture, is why supposedly insane war that the West fomented with Ukraine was to decouple Europe from Russia, which was a big thing, because you don't want Germany, uniting with Russia economically, politically, and geopolitically, because the whole strategy of the last, 100 years, 120, 130 years with the Mackinder Doctrine is to separate, keep Eurasia divided, and to control it. And one thing, a big part of that is keeping Germany in constant conflict with Russia. And that's what the 20th century was all about. That's what NATO has been about. Keep Germany down and Russia out, And that's destroying Germany to achieve this.
I also think it was that they could see that the technical advantage in terms of warfare was fading fast. They could see that China, Russia, and Iran were all coming on quickly. And remember, we are a de-industrialized nation. I mean, don't forget that. We can't manufacture anything. And we can't manufacture troops. I mean, you go to the mall and you might see, like, out of 1,000 people, you can imagine 2 or 3 men that might be of fighting capacity, but none of them would ever join the army because they're all aware it's just a transgender disco. And so, these things ultimately have consequences. We've shipped out to China our industry, and we've made our fighting men into a transgender disco inhabitants. Well, eventually you get to the point where you can't defend yourself. Well, I would just suggest that we're closing in on that moment. And then the other hand, China, Russia, Iran, these are fighting nations. These are nations on the uptick. They're all developing technology, and their populations, which are huge, are much more virile. I mean, I just think that what's happening in the Ukrainian war is an attempt to basically weaken Russia before the door closes, and it just becomes impossible for the transgenderized, deindustrialized West to mount even like a token battalion to try to stop the Russian invasion. So it's I think that's kind of, as they tell the story, that's sort of in the background as one of the rationales.
Yeah, well, they've made war on the human stock of the country. They've devalued it. They're flooding with, right at the same time we're trying to project power, we have the federal government conspiring to open up the borders and flood it with foreigners to change the demographics and, to do whatever to the country, whether it's to bring in voters or just to kind of replace the heritage white population, and so you can't do those things simultaneously.
Exactly.
You can't project power at any time weakening your country. That's what they've been trying to do. This is a problem that you just live by illusions. That they don't live in reality. And that's what happened with Israel and Iran and Russia is they simply didn't have a grasp on reality. They don't have, and what happens is the West, largely because of its because it's alliance. Well, there is no formal alliance, but the fact that the United States and the West is so tied in with Israel and the Jews, it's hurt their reputation, and you know, also the bad faith geopolitics of the West. You know, the rules based system, which is our rules, that those are the rules of what we say, and our the weaponization of human rights. People kind of know what it is now. It's regime change. It's pushing degeneracy. These things, and so when U.S. goes abroad and talks to human rights. And with its NGOs and these other organizations that are out there supposedly fighting human rights, people know that it's there to undermine the government. Therefore, the U.S. has lost soft power because people no longer look at the American system and American values have any credibility because it's all about degeneracy and and so then all you have is hard power. Well, evidently, they're losing that advantage, as you see in the Ukraine.
Yeah, so you can see the future of the West is grim. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of the decisions that they made to, you know, benefit from their exploitation of our populations, like by making money with the offshoring of industry and by turning the male population into homosexuals and transgenders. I mean, I think that's an honest, you know, description of one of the agendas going on here. I mean, ultimately, even though they may have enjoyed the process and gotten some benefits from it, you end up with a nation that can't really do anything geopolitically, right? I mean, and so you can kind of, actually the world sort of all makes sense at the moment. Mm-hmm. Because the nations that have a like stronger kind of cultural family value orientation, they are on the ascendant, obviously.
Well, it's right? going to naturally shift back to a multipolarity. Because that's the kind of way it should work.
Yeah.
And America, for at least up until the 1940s, its dominance was kind of based on its productivity. And then, of course, the destruction of Europe in World War II kind of put America on top. And its currency was king. The dollar was king. And that they abused that exorbitant privilege, and they started deindustrializing. They over relying on financialization. You know, what's the what do they call it? The real estate. What's that economy? What's that term?
Oh gosh, it slips my mind. I know what you're talking about, though.
Basically, it's financialization. It's real estate. That's the thing. So service economy. So there's no there anymore, other than a bluff.
Well, but, you know, I would just point out that it's always been kind of a bluff in the sense that we've always projected the idea that we're democratic. But if you actually look at our behavior, if you look at, you know, how the U.S. invasion of every country imaginable, look at its raping of Central America with United Fruit, right?
Yeah.
And Mays and that stuff, you know. So it's always basically been oligarchic. It just had... It had a more believable story, you know, in the 50s and 60s following World War II than it does now, because at this point it's just exposed. I mean, it's a axis of evil at this point, frankly. And you don't want anything of American culture or American business or particularly American financing inside your nation. It just leads to destruction and slavery. I mean, that is, as I experience the world, as I get communications from people in South America and India, that's what they say. They all have, no matter where they are, they have an understanding of America as a degenerate and evil nation.
Okay, so it's America's the great Satan. It means they can't exercise soft power because everyone sees it for what it is. And it's losing hard power because basically the degenerate society that America's become does not have the capacity to maintain the economy, the power base to project power anymore.
But you know, this actually has an impact on Israel, because if they want to establish the world ruler, Messiah, and they need to ride American power to that. And I think the window's shutting for that as well.
Sorry, it's the fire economy, it's financialization, insurance, and real estate. Yeah.
Yeah. In other words, all just, you know, paper shuffling, you know,
yes.
There's no productivity of anything. So since Israel depends on the United States and we are in such sharp decline, I think that they kind of thought, well, we've got to get the red heifer going now. We can't wait. to the next.
Saw that with the ADL. That was there was that phone call that what's his name? You know, the guy runs the ADL.
Not Adelson, but I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank.
So
I know it is. It'll come in a second.
But he was on a Jonathan Greenblatt, yeah.
Right.
He was on a conference call. Apparently, it was like intercepted by Iranian intelligence. I might have that wrong. If it is, that's great. But he was talking about they're losing the younger generation. They've lost. This is why they're panicking over TikTok, right? It's owned by the Chinese, and they don't completely control that platform. And there's too much free speech on TikTok. It's not just girls, you know, showing their private parts. There's actually some political content on there they don't like. If you look at the support for Israel in the United States, it's by generation, and it's baby boomer, aging baby boomer Christian Zionists that support, and the political class. The younger generations don't, and nor do the people they're flooding the country with. They have no affinity with Israel. Exactly, so they're losing support. I mean, so all of a sudden, is it a race against time now?
The Holocaust narrative is not bought by the younger generation.
No, they don't care about it. Even, you know, you just something they know about it, they don't care about it.
They're irrelevant or they're skeptical. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like the majority position. And so because of that, then the expression anti-Semitism doesn't have any kind of intellectual destructive power. So they just keep on thinking when they don't really care if they're called that.
So with every funeral, support for Israel declines.
So. Yeah, that's right. So you can see all of that was kind of, you know, leading up to the red heifer, to use the expression, you know, where they kind of have to act at this point because they can't wait 50 years. So they've got to get something done now if they're going to go for it. And, that's why it is kind of a troubling period coming forward, because they might want to, you know, like as they did with the vaccine mandates, just go draconian in some way, you know, have a kind of a nuclear war requiring martial law everywhere. I mean, you know, you can imagine many scenarios and fantasize about them. But
well, there's the Samson option, right?
Yeah, well, that would be what would happen if they got into a shootout with Iran and Iran took out their military.
But haven't they like threatened like to bomb Europe?
Sure.
Wait a second. You're at war with Iran. Why are you bombing Europe?
Right. Well, the Samson option is basically the destruction of the world if the Jews feel like they're threatened.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a completely self-centered and racist position. It's self-interest. I mean,
acknowledging they've brought that upon themselves.
Well, of course not. But the problem with that is they've got to be able to get the nukes out, to wipe out the world. And one of the things that if the hypersonics are ever unleashed en masse by Iran, that's bound to be their first target, would be to take out every, nuclear missile silo that Israel has. And I mean, I'm over my head here because they don't really understand, you know, the military capacity of Israel.
Well, remember back in 1973, it's been reported that as Israel was being overwhelmed, 73, and Nixon went to bat for them, and Nixon put on, you know, it was a DEFCON 3 or so, or Kanye West, DEFCON 3 or something. And they, apparently that happened because Golda Meir threatened to attack Russia with a nuclear weapon. Soviet Union.
Yeah, that's the story, and it's kind of plausible, that kind of blackmail. But the problem is, if you take away the power of the nuke, I mean, the scenario I kind of laid out is actually not completely fanciful. I mean, if Israel even for a day lost its military power, its neighbors would flood on in.
Yeah,
and what are you going to do? I mean, by the time any kind of, the fighting transgender, you know, battalion could get there from Europe, it would be all over. I mean, you know, the hatred is so intense that Israel has to be armed and keep its neighbors at bay. Otherwise, they'll just come in and slaughter everybody. So I don't know this as a fact, but I'm just, this would be logical, you know, and so therefore, you know, it's the Samson option would, you know, be taken away from the Israelis if they can get the silos destroyed before they can get the bombs out.
Well, let's say Israel goes away. So the diaspora, well, what would you call it? Refugees. They'd just be dispersed again, like the Babylonian go to the Western countries. I mean, if anyway, it's, you know, the Israel has always been the Jewish people. It's not necessarily a piece of real estate. So prior to 1948, there was an Israel. There was an Irish. People actually use the term Israel to refer to the diaspora, Jewish people. And they enjoyed extraordinary influence, inordinate influence throughout the Western world up until then, particularly after the 19th century, late 19th century into the early 20th century, you know, when all the obstacles were removed. Even before that, a few Jews were extraordinarily influential. But it was the latter half of the 19th century, you know, in the wake of liberalism, that the Jews were able to prosper and gain so much influence throughout the West. In many respects, the diaspora is more of a long-term problem for the world than this piece of real estate in the Middle East, because at least that piece of real estate in the Middle East, everyone can look at it, and there's a state you can point to and blame. You could say it's a lightning rod for criticism, it's ultimately, is it a liability for the Jewish people?
If they had gone at the end of World War II to Madagascar or some other place to establish, you know, a homeland for the Jews, the world would be at peace at the moment and the future. But they had to fulfill what they see as the kind of foundation prophecies and religion that Freemasonry is based on. And so they had to have that section of real estate. And, you know, it's, even though if you look at their own history, I mean, it's not like they have a continuous occupation of it. I mean, first of all, the story starts out when they're enslaved in Egypt. And then as soon as they're there for a while, they get removed and taken to Babylonia, right, where they have to eventually come back from. And following that, Alexander comes in. He takes over the place, Alexander the Great. He's about to convert all of the Jews, his descendants, the Seleucids, they're going to convert them to Hellenistic culture. Mm-hmm. It's going to be just a democracy and beauty and art, you know, is coming into this area. Hasmoneans have to like reconquer the place, right? Well, this only lasts 150 years, and then the Romans kick them out, and then the diaspora occurs, you know, with force. So the tradition of the ownership of the land is not, you know, it's spotted at best.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And they could have easily have, you know, thought of, well, since this area is populated, let's try to go someplace where we would be welcomed. But instead, you know, the real problem with Israel is they lied their way in and stole their way in.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they could have established a homeland there if they had respected the rights of nationhood of the Palestinians. But if you look at the letters, you know, I always mention, you know, Nur Masala's The Expulsion of the Palestinians. It has been a 100% goal of the Zionists to get rid of the Palestinians from this moment they had the idea. So they've always had this idea in mind that there's going to be a Jewish state. And to get it, they had to be violent and also to lie. And so this is really the birthright of the nation and why it has led to so much chaos. Is that it lied its way into existence. Read McMahon's letter to Hussein. You can see it. It's online. They lied their way into existence, and then they have used violence in order to push the Palestinians out. So this is the country. You know, it has this background, and now so many people in the area just hate it. And going forward, it's just going to be more bloodbath.
And it's the same thing a similar problem with the diaspora in the various host countries everywhere they go because of Tikkun Olam, they presume the right to subvert your society in objectives they think of as progressive. There's that American Jewish Council Committee's video, that girl, that vapid girl, talking about how Jews have always been behind gay rights and feminism and abortion and all that. So, yeah, that's the problem. But there she's just bragging about it like it's something great, you know, promoting all this degenerate stuff and infanticide and these things that lead to the dissolution of the host society and wondering why there's problems. And has there been a society that's more opening and tolerant of Jews in the United States? Well, they abuse that tolerance, that freedom, to work for the dissolution of the country. whether it's through immigration or culture dissolution, Hollywood and promoting degeneracy. And they wonder why there's resentment, you know.
Yeah, and it's always, you know, it's really this kind of fight to the death, you know, kind of position that they have in relation to the host culture, because they come in and you end up with things like Hollywood and the financial system, the, you know, the banking system and the fiat currency in the United States. These aren't, you know, they're not trying to gain it like a foothold or something. I mean, this is actually, they're trying to just completely destroy the
dominate
culture.
It as the financial system
control and destroy it. I mean,
well, it's not just a coincidence. As the financial system has become dominated by Jews, it's become predatorial and dysfunctional. See the connection there? Why is that? Because it's usurious, it's exploitative. It doesn't acknowledge any limitations or morality. These things have material consequences. You destroy the human capital of the country by corrupting its population. They don't see the connection there. You promote degeneracy. All of a sudden, you don't have a workforce that's as productive. You know, because there's a connection between morality and economics. Supposed used to be a subset of morality. You know, they've turned it on its head to rationalize, you know, their greed. And so it's and they justify it with the Talmud.
Yeah. You know, I think that they, you know, they know perfectly well that these systems will eventually fail, but they design them, in my opinion, in order to destroy the host culture. They know that like the fiat currency goes to zero, but in the process, they also think that the host population will be reduced dramatically and that their political power can go into the ascendancy.
Because they don't see the goyim, the non-Jews, as fully human beings. They see them as cattle to be managed and exploited. And so if you do have a healthy society where people are receive a good modicum of education, are productive, they're sober, there's communities, and it's reproductive, it's regenerative, not degenerative, they can't control that. Better to rule in hell than serve in heaven. You know,
anyone who thinks that you're exaggerating with that statement, have them explain why Netanyahu refers to the Palestinians as Amalek. Let's have that taken.
He's the head of state, because supposedly a modern state, using that terminology,
using the description of someone who is of a race cursed by God.
Yes,
right? Amalek. He's using that expression against the Palestinians, this people that have been suffering for like 100 years under the heel of the Zionists. Have them explain. See, if they doubt what you've said, say, okay, Netanyahu calls them Amalek. How can he do that if he has some sort of respect for their humanity? Mm-hmm. What he respects is the political vision of the Torah, which the chosen people are able to genocide all of the other populations on the planet. That's what he respects. What he does not respect, the humanity of the Palestinians. He could never, ever use that expression, any sort of empathy for it. And he uses it over and over again. He didn't. And so even if that was real, which I think is absolutely not true, he completely ignored the last 100 years. He completely ignores, you know, how this population has been attacked over and over again. And if they do have a rebellion, then, well, Amalek, they're cursed by God. So this is the truth, and what you declared, I don't know what to say, Tim, other than I think it's absolutely correct.
Well, the cycle of violence did not begin in that area until a bunch of Polish communist Jews showed up, gangsters, and started it. And then there was tit for tat response. You know, that's when it starts. You know,
it starts with Hussein's correspondent with McMahon, where they say, you know, we're going to let all of Arabia have political independence, meaning from like the Nile all the way, you know, to the Euphrates. That all the McMahon's letter is very clear. You know, okay, you fight for us, you defeat the Ottoman Empire, you're on our side, and you're going to get to have your independence. What the Ottomans, you know, didn't give you, we will. And then, okay, you have the Balfour Declaration before the war is even over, right? Here it is. They they lied their way into existence, right?
Well, you could make the argument that World War One was extended a year and a half, 2 years solely to vindicate or to fulfill the creation of the Israeli state. It's the Balfour Declaration, because that's what secures U.S. participation.
Right, and then, of course, bear in mind that this was prophesized by Archduke Ferdinand's license plate. So in other words, all of these things were understood going into World War One, the dates of it, of the armistice, and also, therefore, they could actually see the way, the process by which they could lie to the Arabs, get them on board, and then fracture their political unity and insert Israel. This was, believe me, the plan didn't come into existence with the Balfour Declaration. I mean, remember, Palmerston in 1840 said now is the time for the Jews to return to homeland. So this has been going on for like 80 years before the Balfour Declaration, and every step of the way they were lying. And of course, they were always willing to use violence whenever they needed to. So, you know, here we are now with the heifer about to bite the bullet on the Temple Mount, and the nuclear war kind of, in sort of swirling in the mist and fantasy, hopefully, but nevertheless, it's a thought. And it all goes back to this fundamentalist, kind of worldview that these people hold on to that comes out of the Talmud.
Yep. Yeah. Didn't the U.S. veto a UN, was it the Security Council?
Yeah.
Oh, there was a condemnation of the attack on April 1st, and the U.S.
And the idea that they could become a state was also put forward. Yeah. And vetoed both.
I mean, it's that. This is why the U.S. has no. I mean, it used to. Remember the days the U.S. tried to present itself as a honest broker in the region.
God, I can remember that. They were always lying. They never were.
I know, but at least there was some pretense.
They had lip service toward it. Now they're just draconian. They're just part of the Knesset. They just attack anyone that asks for some kind of human rights for the neighbors and inhabitants of Israel who aren't Jews.
And now everyone's outraged about the protests, like in San Francisco and in Chicago. And now the Republicans come out and condemn the protests when they were all silent about Black Lives Matter 4 years ago.
Right. Google had like 25 employees, just something like that, about 25 employees. They had a protest and they were saying, Google is like making all of these technical tools that are going to be used in the genocide of the Palestinians. They actually listed a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And Google says, yeah, well, thanks for your input, and then fired them all.
Well, how many people of Israel's unit 8,200 work at Google? Look into that.
Yeah, a lot.
They infest the communication high tech companies of the West. That's another thing people should look into.
I mean, MK Ultra produced the personal computer, mm-hmm. And it was done with the idea of using it for mind control, which was the other half of the MK Ultra project. Well, the other third, they were also going to do, rock and roll, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But anyway, so, I mean, look, the country, if you drive around like Los Angeles or San Francisco and see the empty retail spaces and see the tent cities with people collapsed on the sidewalk, and then imagine where it was in 1950. I mean, and
they're sending $100 billion to Ukraine.
But just think of all of the technical advances, right? The wisdom that we've accumulated over the last, 70 years, right? And then to think of like LA and San Francisco becoming so debased that you can't even walk on the sidewalks. This couldn't have occurred accidentally.
Didn't they used to manufacture television sets in Philadelphia?
Yeah.
And now, look, I think it was on Kensington Avenue.
Electronics, yeah, Kensington Avenue, right.
Look at it now. Now it's zombies. And the zero states become the zombie state. And that's it's America now. And I was wondering, I mean, heck, if holding school prayer in the morning in a classroom violates the First Amendment's separation or non-establishment clause. They say separation of church and state, although that's not in the Constitution. They've extended that from the establishment clause. How about subsidizing a Jewish state to the tens of billions of dollars a year? Isn't that a violation of
How could, yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's,
You were subsidizing red heifer sacrifices?
right? I mean, we should, the poor red heifer, I mean, you know, he doesn't, he didn't do anything. He
For what
was
I
just,
understand, the sac, it's particularly, don't they, they'd like bleed it out or something? It's like,
God, it's so disgusting. I mean, the
well, it's so
idea,
primitive. It's like these guys that,
savage.
Well,
I mean,
it's going to expiate their sin or something. These are the people that like swing chickens over their back of their, you know, they take chicken decks. And from what I understand, they kill all these chickens in New York and they leave the chickens on the street for people to clean up.
I don't know. I stay away from New York and I don't like to deal
But the
with
idea is you could sacrifice an animal to wipe away your sins and the sins you're going to commit. Theologically, philosophically, that is so like primitive and so, I mean, it's like,
right, and it's just like it's a warrior, racist, primitive culture religion. I mean, that's just what it is, and to bring it back in this form with the idea of like sacrificing a fully grown animal. I mean, this is a in such a public way. They I don't know if you've seen the stage they built for the ritual.
Yeah,
they have this huge stage with a ramp up to lead the animal up, and then this platform, and the rabbi is going to get there. I don't know how they're going to kill this
Is
thing.
Jared Kushner funding this or something? Raising money.
I think he's the one doing the
Did you see
sacrifice.
That thing? There was a film of Palestinians that were playing swimming and playing volleyball on a beach recently.
Yeah.
And the video came out. And of course, that probably bothered Jared Kushner because that's his beachfront property. They shouldn't be there, right?
Yeah, no. Yeah.
But apparently I heard this, that Israelis were upset because it's a sign that they're not being harsh enough on the Palestinians, that they have time to have some sort of recreation or cool themselves off in the water.
Yeah, because these people are Amalek and they beheaded babies.
Well,
so.
The thing about that, you think at the very, if they were somewhat politically savvy or you know, media savvy, they'd say, look, it ain't that bad. These people are recreating on the beach. But
Right.
No, they turn around and they complain that this is a sign that life isn't hard enough on the people who live in Gaza. Or, you know, like,
yeah,
you know, that's a bad look.
the racism has really been inculcated in the Israelis over the last. I mean, if you read the letters that Nir Mussallah presents in Expulsion of the Palestinians, the racism was very strong going into the creation of Israel. But at least there was this lip service to the rest of the world, right? They would. That to be the public face, no longer. I mean, now you know they. I mean, this is a good example of just how overt it is, and you know they're cocky. They feel like they have all of the military advantage, and they can just be.
Well, like I said, this is
they want.
When organized Jews control so much of you know these choke points, whether financial, informational, media. Cultural, they you know, and they can prevent the public discourse. At least the politicians are representatives from dealing with the issue. They have a you know, AIPAC has Congress under control, so our political establishment, our political process has no way of dealing with this particular matter, this problem, because it's a category that's where that we're not allowed to acknowledge, even though it's a very real category. It's probably the most important political question of our era is the level of Jewish influence in our political system and how it's screwing the world up, screwing our societies up. And we can't address it because none of our political leaders, they're all bought out or bribed or whatever, or you know, or whatever, you know.
Yeah, talking about it is a reflection of anti-Semitism.
Yes. No matter what they do, you know. If you're taken aback by red heifer sacrifices and
right,
fulfilling prophecy, you're an anti-Semite.
Right. This is the complete clown world where you have the red heifer sacrifice and the inability to discuss kind of like undemocratic Jewish power all being defined as anti-Semitic, right? And so you can't, the what is real is forbidden and what is false is deified. It's the clown world, you know, that this is the people then look at this and they go, well, it's just, this is all absurd. I don't want to participate in it. That's the wrong response. Citizens should say, wait a second, we're being led off a cliff. We have to resist. We have to speak publicly to break the you know, the power of the terms that they use to keep us from thought, right? conspiracy theorist, white supremacist, truther. You know, these things have to be swept aside by public analysis so that, you know, they don't have the power to stop thought, because we really need to, you know, kind of rework our minds so that we can think clearly enough to resist.
Yep. Well, okay, Joe, I think we covered it.
Yeah, I think so, Tim. We missed the we'll have to deal with the problems with the income tax next week.
Yeah, I was doubtful whether we could cover two things.
Yeah, it's an exciting topic. I mean, this could be a very interesting week. Let's hope it's a peaceful one.
Hopefully. Take care, Joe.
You too, buddy.
Bye-bye. Next week.